building, so we ask people not to have any fragrances on when they come in, because we do have people that are affected by the use of fragrances. So we will start off with the reading of the declaration, which is, this policy is read no matter where you're located in the world at a lodge as an opening for a meeting. It gives a full overview of what ULT, United Lodge of Theosophists, stands for. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles. Through a true realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between the associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by studying otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So here in Philadelphia, we meet weekly, twice a week. On Sundays, we usually have either a talk or a lecture or a panel discussion on some atmosphere of the philosophy. This starts at 11 a.m. and it goes to 12 noon. The doors are opened at 10:30. Now we are getting towards the end of the mysteries of the animal kingdom, which we've been approaching this whole month of April. Today, of course, we're going to be doing the human and animal relationship. And next Sunday, the final one, will be the pros and cons of vegetarianism. Then we wanted to mention also our Wednesday classes. We are studying In the Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. That study class starts at 7:30 and runs to 8:30. Also on Wednesday, we have our reference library open from 5:15 to 7:15. It's there for your use. There's usually a student there that can help you with any ideas or references you'd want to look up. Plus, there's usually a reference for that evening's class that's to be very helpful for the class. So that takes care of those two. Now, we did want to mention coming up in May, which will be here very soon, On May 6th, we have White Lotus Day. It's a special commemorative type meeting. It will be titled H.P. Blavatsky and Theosophy. Again, we ask people, since it's a more of a devotional type meeting, that if they could get here a little early and be seated so we can have sort of a thinking type class on that. Now, we did want to go back and mention that in the ocean class, we will be finishing up the 14th chapter, and it's called The Earth, Its Ages and Cataclysms, which is a very interesting topic that we are approaching. So that takes care of all our announcements. So this morning, we will be approaching the idea in this whole cover of the animals situation. We will be covering it with a short form talk on the human/animal relationships. And then afterwards, there will be a time period for questions, answers, comments made.
Human-animal relationship. At last we have a subject with some oohs and ahs. We just can't help it when you see the little puppy's face or a small kitten or foal making their way around the world for the first time. Domesticated cats and dogs have been around for over 15,000 years, according to skeletal remains found at archaeological digs. Petitioning humans their oppressor, their better life, or recognition of their rights isn't going to happen. Humans decide rights. Animals can't think that way. They don't have what we would call moral behavior. There isn't a group of animals covering up their genitalia because some in their group find it morally reprehensible. They don't tell stories to their grandchildren or convey a yield sign. Building a machine to do something when they aren't there is not conceived of, much less done. They can't make a communication or a sensing device past what they were born with. We now see infrared, ultraviolet, and all the other spectrums of light. We invent, they adapt. The larger thing is, animals don't show the kind of spiritual markers we are capable of. Compassion, forgiveness, grace, joy, and yes, love, but in the sense of belonging to everything. Animals have heightened their adaptability to live in the niches they evolved in. They have coded instincts, we don't. An instinct is an inborn complex pattern of behavior that must exist in every member of the species, and because it is embedded in the genetic code, it cannot be overcome by the force of will. Ours are limited when we're born. We're limited to sucking, pain, falling, and being startled. Laughter in humans comes after a few months. Not so in animals. This instinct of the animals, which act from the moment of their birth, each in the confines prescribed to them by nature, and which know how to take care of themselves unerringly, this instinct may, for the sake of exact definition, be termed automatic. But it must have either within the animal which possesses it, or without an intelligence to guide it. Humans, as opposed to animals, have the mind principle, manas, lit up, or activated, if you will, and now they are the thinker, the reincarnating being, the immortal who carries the results and values of all the different lives lived on Earth or elsewhere. Its nature becomes dual as soon as it is attached to a body, for the human brain is a superior organism, and manas uses it. I lost my place. and manas uses it to reason from premise to conclusion. This also differentiates man from animal, for the animal acts from automatic and so-called instinctual impulses, whereas the man can use reason. This is the lower aspect of the thinker, or manas, and not, as some have supposed, the highest. Its other, and in theosophy, higher aspect is the intuitional, which knows and does not depend on reason. The role of an animal in the modern age is primarily that of companionship and food. Other cultures, however, did not always behold animals in such a manner. In fact, cultures like that of ancient Egypt used some animals for survival purposes and associated others with God and goddesses, using them for sacrificial purposes. Certain animals were deified according to their beliefs. Way back about 2,500 years ago, the genius philosopher and extraordinary mathematician named Pythagoras used an urged respect for animals because he believed that humans and non-humans had the same kind of soul, one spirit that pervades the universe and makes us one with animals. And as a quick aside, Pythagoras was reportedly the first animal liberationist. He would buy animals from markets in order to set them free. Getting back, Madame Blavatsky said similarly, the two oldest religions, Hinduism and Buddhism, regard the animal world from the huge quadruped down to the infinitesimally small insect as their younger brothers. Most certainly, they are speaking of a never-ending human-animal relationship. So what is it that binds us humans so closely to the animal kingdom? Theosophically, it is the monad. The word monad is generally defined in dictionaries as being primary unit or ultimate unit. In some of the more basic and foundational textbooks of philosophy, or philosophy of theosophy, such as The Key to Theosophy by H.P. Blavatsky, or The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge, the term monad is used quite simply and applies to the conjunction of the two highest principles of man, the inner man, the spiritual constitution of the human being, namely Atma and Buddhi. Atma being pure, eternal spirit, one with the absolute, infinite, omnipresent, divine principle, can effectively have no connection with or influence on anything differentiated, manifested, or conditioned, except through Buddhi, the spiritual soul, which serves as the vehicle through which the divine light and radiance of Atma shines through to Manas, the next highest principle, and which is our reincarnating ego, our permanent individuality. The human monad, whether in the stone atom, or in the plant, or in the animal, is still and ever a divine, hence also a human monad. It ceases to be the human only when it becomes absolutely divine. The terms mineral, vegetable, and animal monad are meant to create a superficial distinction. There is no such thing as a monad other than divine, and consequently having been or having to become human. The monad is a drop out of the shoreless ocean beyond. It is divine in its higher and human in its lower condition. So the monad has, during the cycle of its incarnations, to reflect in itself every root form of each kingdom. Therefore, the Kabbalists say correctly that man becomes a stone, a plant, an animal, a mant, a spirit, and finally, God. Modern science recognizes matter as living and dead, organic and inorganic, and life as merely a phenomenon of matter. Occult science recognizes, foremost of all, the postulate that there is no such thing in nature as inorganic substances or body. Theosophy recognizes one universal, all-pervading life. Modern science recognizes life as a special phenomenon of matter, a mere transient manifestation due to temporary conditions. Even logic and analogy ought to have taught us better, for the simple reason that so-called inorganic or dead matter constantly becomes organic and living, while matter from the organic plane is continually being reduced to the inorganic. How rational and justifiable, then, to suppose that the capacity or potency of life is latent in all matter. Finally, there is no absolute separateness in nature. Mineral, plant, animal, and humans all are made of the same essence and have the same spiritually divine potential, and are interlinked by magnetic lines of understanding. It is impossible to realize our full potential unless we recognize the spiritual unity of all living beings and make universal brotherhood, or should I say universal monadhood, the keynote of our lives. Once again, the topic for today, the animal-human relationship.
Well, for most, it would seem that we can acknowledge all that was said on a mild basis. We would like just to ask, just for an idea, who in this room has had or has or works with the animal kingdom? Can we have a show of hands just to get an idea? Well, look around you. There are some that haven't, but for most, it's common. It's very common. Either we had it as children, we were approached with animals at a young age, our parents were very careful that we understood that what a pet was and what the responsibility comes with owning a pet. So in large range, the animal kingdom has been a companion with man and women for many centuries. Many centuries, yes.
We would suggest that if we broaden our understanding of that question, who among us has worked with the animal kingdom, would have to include all of us. Because as we understand it, that ego that incarnates into a human form that is partly animal, has animal instinct, animal life. So even in our own nature, there's an intimate relationship between our divine human nature and the vehicle which we use, which is made up of all the kingdoms, but we feel it most from our animal nature.
Yes, and if you think about it, just the stages of a newborn baby, the stages prior to birth, have gone through all the, shall we say, lower kingdoms of that of the mineral, the vegetable, the animal, that whole building up to that birth of a human soul. So we see the connection there. We sort of wonder about how we feel, and it just seems like now more is heard either in the news, through the television, through groups of people, the closeness and the feeling of we have many animals that are coming into shelters that need to be adopted, that need to be brought in to some family of some sort of love and attention that can be given to it. That whole idea of what an animal is and how we fit in with it is something that we've been imbued with throughout. Our whole body is made up of all these different parts too.
It was just said that the vehicle that we use is made up of all the kingdoms, and we probably feel the animal nature within us mostly. So if we're not the vehicle and we're using it and it kind of is more like a perfected animal, well, don't we then, as human souls, we have a relationship to the vehicle, to the animal within us? And so maybe there's an analogy between our relationship within us and the harmony or disharmony within it. Maybe there's an analogy there to the relationship of mankind as a whole to animals in the world.
Very much so, you would see, because we have to look back. Historically, before they were, quote, pets, they were a help to any human individual, depending how it was used. They were like used for just in the idea of the horse, the mule, the idea that, or it could have been the camel, depending what the area is, that if they were used by us to improve our life, to improve our way of living. And it wasn't until later that they were actually regarded as a pet that one could cherish and love and do certain things with. At the beginning, it was mostly a help to mankind. Yes, way in the back.
I think it's probably very difficult to love a camel. They have too many human characters. It's awful when you think about it. The animals that are in shelters were bred for profit, to be sold to human beings. And that's just wrong. There's also religious activities and festivals that are wrong. There's the Buddhist festival where you free an animal that is caged? Well, it's mostly birds that have been caught to be sold at the festival. They would never have been caged if it weren't for the festival. So we kind of have everything upside down and backwards.
In a way, yes, because they are in their own, shall we say, vehicle of life, gaining experience and giving experience to those around us. So this whole idea of how it was used and why it was used, and then to the point where this idea of using it for a commercial reason is another point to bring up too. But the fact of the matter, we are akin to the animal kingdom, way in the back.
And we know that Christianity, with the Bible translations, it says about man having dominion over the earth. And we think that some people have taken that quite literally and feel as though the earth is theirs to use without any kind of concern as to the future, or with animals, to their feelings as well. They don't, so many people don't believe that animals feel pain, fear, and they do love. So it's, in many respects, it's a religious issue as to how so many of these animals are being maltreated.
We can say that to be, because we know it as a fact, but yet if we look to, shall we say, the youth of the world today, their feelings are much different than those. And it's, we are companions. We found many references that we thought were very helpful. The whole idea about the karma of an animal, when we say about that. We found many references in many magazines, but the fact that with Mr. Judge's questions and answers sessions that he has with the ocean are very interesting. We find out, we speak of our astral body, well, the animals have an astral body too that survives the physical form for a very short period. And that the shall we say, the soul of the animal reincarnates, and it can, in a higher species, because we are aware of there are certain animals, as you think, God, that animal's brilliant and knows exactly how to do it. Animals can be well trained. Some are well equipped for certain things that they do. We see a lot more situations where we hear about animals being taken to older people's homes, the commercial homes, but taking them in, and the idea of some of those people never knew from a pet, but the fact that they get something feeling from it, from the idea that they can pet the animal, they can hold the animal, there's a very close loving feeling there. It's also helping those individuals survive with what they're living with as they get older. Yes.
Now, you mentioned all animals, all life has an astral, and since the brain of most animals is not developed, they don't have speech, or they don't, isn't this astral, this magnetic, electromagnetic body, this sort of our feeling nature, is how we communicate with the animal world. It's how we feel that they pick up on. They are very sensitive, because the ones that are not predatory, but those prey animals, are very sensitive to the atmosphere around them, to for where danger is and,
right.
And just the weather in general.
And there are times that people will come in with a group into a home that has an animal. And some animals are very approachable. And even the animal will go towards it. There are times that the same situation, their animal will not go towards a certain individual. There's a sense, an instinctual sense that they know. There's just something there that's static, shall we say, and they don't want to feel that static. So they would back off. There's quite a lot of their instinctual intelligence is something that we see all the time. Yes.
The higher principles which we all share in common, the mind being latent to a large degree in animals, but when animals die, do they come back as a higher, more intelligent form of the same animal, or do they need to go through all the various bodies and experiences and circumstances of the animal kingdom at large?
From a lot of the references that we found in connection with that, that part, that it is a point that it says an animal can go into a higher species of animal, because we do know there are some species that are quite high on the scale of intelligence. And the fact that, yes, this can happen. And it has, shall we say, the seeds, we could call it, as was stated, of all the human principles in itself, but they're all latent. They're not activated at this point in the development. The monad that is in the animal kingdom, for instance, it's there, but it's latent, yes.
We're getting into like real metaphysics in this kind of a conversation, which you can't avoid. It's a metaphysical discussion. And in doing so, we don't have the words in English to accurately describe really what's going on there. We have to be careful not to give the impression that a dog reincarnates again and he comes back. He doesn't. A human being does. The spiritual soul, whatever we call, of any given animal goes into the soup of the ocean. It doesn't ever go away. And it adds to the wisdom and the life and the experience of the universe. But once Rover is dead, he's never coming back. There's never another Rover. He's not coming back as a smarter Rover. It's over. The spiritual principles which make up Rover re-embody, which is why it's so important to use the word re-embody. Which is
good point.
For every other thing, human beings reincarnate. It's completely different.
Right. Good point. That's in one of these that are coming up. We've got that. The other thing includes here. This is interesting. The astral phantom of all things that have lived, animals included, await their second death. For animals, it comes with the disintegration and entire fading out of their astral particles to the last. So it's not like Rover, who we knew, is back, coming back again. It's a different situation. And also, it says, Mr. Judge brings it up in the ocean, about the evolution on this earth, which needs the monad as its vivifying agent. Okay, now the differentiation between the manus, the thinker, and man from the animal, for the animal acts from automatic instinctual impulses, whereas the human can reason. So it also gives us enough feelings of the fact that it's a gradual growth. It's nothing that comes overnight. But we can have feelings towards animals. And sometimes there have been situations where individuals have had a pet, it passed away, and yet every so often they seem, if they're in the living room or the kitchen or wherever they were, something passes the individual and they go, they think it's the dog or the cat that was. It's not physically possible, but within this metaphysical area, it's like animals can see in the dark the way we cannot. They don't need to have a flashlight to maneuver. It's not an innate thing for us to be able to walk into a pitch black room and know where to go and where not to go. So this instinctual part of the nature that has been embedded within the whole nature of whatever animal it is, it's, some are easy to train, others are not. Some are very good as compatibles, others are not. It all depends, again, on this previous development and where it is, way in the back.
I think it was either Mr. Judge or HPB does make a statement that animals in each specific species does have to learn all the lessons that that particular species has to teach before
it can
move up into a higher one.
Right. And it's a thing that it will gradually continue to move on a higher range. Yes.
Well, regarding the human being, the physical body, the personality we know ourselves to be, that's not coming back either.
That's
no
true.
More than the animal. What does incarnate is the mind being, the individual thinking principle. So we were just reading on the internet that reincarnation is the teaching that a human being can reincarnate as an animal, a plant, an insect. What does theosophy have to teach about the human, or that human mind being, that human being incarnating into an animal?
Well, we can say this much. Sometimes we have met people who really have certain animal qualities that are overwhelming, a bitterness of this or that. But the fact of the matter, we are thinkers. We are pure spirit soul thinkers. And we would not be, we could react and maybe act, as you would call, an animal instinct. Well, what is an animal instinct? If it's of a negative source, that's where we could call it. But once man, the thinker, enters the scene, we do not go back into lower, shall we say, lower kingdoms. Yes?
Can you follow up, please? That, quote, negative animal instinct that you described, how much of that is inherent to the nature of the animal, and how much of that is due to its close relationship between the human's own bitterness or evil has infected or changed the way that animal was naturally, and we're not speaking of domesticated animals, but even animals in the wild.
Oh, definitely. Definitely, you brought up that point. Those animals can sense this within a human being. And as was stated earlier, certain animals that are domesticated, and even ones that aren't domesticated, they have certain reactions towards the human. And most of the vile things that we see, you know, their life in the wild is, for each animal, as a young chap, has to follow the directions of its mother. A mother will teach them how to hunt, when to hunt, how to do this, how to do that. Because these are basic things. They need to eat, they need to rest, they need to sleep, and they also need to be active. So the idea that this instinct that we talk about in the lower kingdoms of the animals, this is something that's been imbued in them. And all the lines previously from the mother and the mother's mother and the mother's mother, all this has been brought down to them. So technically, some of the negativeness that we acquire and say about certain animals are really human qualities that have gone a while. Yes.
But added to that, there are animal habits that are unexplainable. For instance, in Morocco, all of the transit of everything is by donkeys. The streets are very, very narrow. When a donkey gets sick, the donkey takes itself to the animal hospital. And the doctors there are ready and aware that if a donkey shows up, it's because it needs them. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, if you want to look it up, that hospital was started by an American woman. Mm-hmm. And nobody taught those donkeys to go there. They taught themselves. Mm-hmm.
Well, when you say they taught themselves, there's had to be some instinctual information that was given to them prior maybe to an elder monkey, an elder donkey. But the fact of the matter is there is intelligence there because all these animals have survived for so long. Yes.
Speak on the same subject. I've seen YouTube videos of, say, for example, people out on the ocean, and a whale or a dolphin or something may show up wrapped up in netting asking for help.
Yep.
Where does that come from? They weren't taught that from,
Well, it's when you say asking for help, it's like there is a lot of cases, mm-hmm, that they go out and the individuals that can be in any situation can see that an animal, shall we say, can feel something, that not on a mental thing, but they can feel it. But there have been those that have been caught up in nets and stuff and had people come out as humans, get that netting off of them and give them that freedom again. There is an acknowledgement of getting off and getting that away. And it seems like it's camaraderie, a feeling of a thankfulness or a helpfulness. Yes.
Is it possible that in a scenario where a sea turtle or a dolphin or a whale approaches a boat, that a couple of things could be going on? From the animal consciousness, the boat up ahead may look like a mother, although with a sea turtle it wouldn't matter because there is no mother-child relationship there. But isn't it also possible that the human beings on that boat are generating a particular level of spirituality or compassion or kindness, that they are literally setting out currents of attraction that an animal might sense this is a safe place to turn?
Mm-hmm. That is very possible. It would seem that's very possible. It's like, how is it that some of them can approach, especially those in the wild, approach a dead animal and will see other animals feasting on it, but the other one goes up to it and backs away? Now, you know it had to have been hungry or it wouldn't have been around with this. But the fact of the matter, they can sense things that we cannot sense. It's the same idea of going into a dark room. They can see things that we cannot see, and they can sense. They can sense negativity. They can sense danger. They can sense pleasure. They can sense things that are so much higher than what we physically can sense, yes.
But we have to bring in universal mind. All consciousness, at whatever level, self-conscious or not, is all part and parcel of universal mind. So there must be moments in life when things connect together. You were just saying that they, the animal kingdom, can sense and know what we can't. Well, that's not true. It's that we are busy looking everywhere else and using our senses for our own satisfaction. We're not trying. They have no choice. They can't think in a different way or decide to be different. We can. So it's universal mind. Everything is there. The germ of self-consciousness is there in the animal, and there must be moments when there is a link, a sympathetic link, as was said, a sense of spirituality where an animal feels safe approaching someone.
Very much so. And not only that, is keep in mind that balance, that the go and the not go, that anxiousness back to the... They have senses that have come within their breed that are like where we would make a choice of one way or another. It's just happens. They just know. That's the way to go. Not this way, but this way. And yet, we can see intelligence in a lot of animals. We can see it, for instance, you see farms that breed horse racing horses. And how they can tell at a very young age, this one's got it, and others don't have it. It's something that sort of oozes out from the animal. You cannot see what you're expected to see. So on another one, you can see there is a yearning to get out, to get forward, to get ahead, to want to do. So we see a lot of these things, and we acknowledge them, but we don't really give any credit to where it's due. And as was saying, we're all one in a way. It's a universal one. There's a universal intelligence that moves the whole universes. So we're one part. The animal is another part. The vegetable is another part. And we can see how the plant life has its own way of moving and growing. And it too, instinctual things within it. The flower that knows to go to look to the sun, not hide back in the shade. We see it all the time and we just never think about it in that way. Yes.
I think more and more scientists recognize that even the cells in the human bodies have an intelligence and a memory. Vygotsky takes it even further and says we're made up of even smaller sensitive lives. Well, wouldn't these lives, when they leave us, go be attracted to the animal kingdom and carry the very impressions of our thought and feeling? And in other words, our lives become food, in that sense, for the animal, as well as we take in their lives.
Is that to do with this?
This very point, there are campsites and health sites where injured or ill children are taken and allowed to ride horses. Mm-hmm. And instinctively, the horse coming into the circle will move towards the most needy, most ill, most suffering child. The horse knows. So we see it all around us. There's an intelligence in every kingdom, and it suits its own level, and we ignore it or we abuse it.
Yeah, ignore it or abuse it. Or it's just not being aware. we think so much, so many individuals think in a box, and they never think to try flipping that lid open. Animals are more, in a way, honest than we could use the word honest, because it's, they just let it all hang out. And it's like, the interesting things is different animals that will combine together, like on a large farm, your pet dog happens to just connect with the goat, this certain goat, and they just become bosom buddies. Wherever that dog goes, that goat follows. You sort of wonder, what the heck, you know? And it's like, don't interfere, just observe it. See what it is. I think there's more balance in the lower kingdoms than there are in the human kingdom sometimes, because they hunt for hunger and to eat. We just eat for the enjoyment until we get sick to our stomachs. Yes.
Back to the idea of the second death. And there's this tradition in Mexico, El Día de Muertos. It's the Day of the Dead. Mm-hmm. Like, it's right after Halloween, where it's the day that you can connect with your ancestors, and they come, they cross this bridge, and you can feel them around you. And so I guess my question is, an animal passes away, and then the principles, as same with human, they start to disintegrate. But if you have remembrance of that animal, or even the person, your ancestors, on the wall with their pictures, in a way it keeps them alive, because you've constantly got them in your consciousness, does that idea stop the principles from disintegrating? Because you're keeping them alive, or that second death is going to happen no matter what?
Well, as far as our understanding from what little we pulled from the philosophy on that is, unless there's a definite stop, there is a routine that is followed in the universe of how things will come in and how they will go out. There are many people that have the feeling that just sometimes they'll turn around, and because they think they just saw, and you know that pet's no longer around, but they feel it. Well, can you imagine of everything in your home that you touch and feel, same as your pets would, you don't think some sort of atmosphere must have rubbed off on it, on that. It's that image you seem to say, or you get the feeling, the dog's watching me, but the dog's not there any longer. These are things that are in the atmosphere, and they will fade out within time. But at the crucial moments, they're still active if that individual wants to feel something. They'll feel something, and it might not even really be there, but they'll feel something. Yes.
But that is all focused in the human kingdom, imagination, perception, psychology, psychism, whatever. If the animal is in essence a soul expressing in that particular condition based on feeling and activity, there's no morality, there's no ethical self-consciousness.
Not
so
in
therefore,
the
there's no right. extra energy that needs to be expended beyond the physical. So the animal form dies. That's the end of that expression. There's no further attachment. And what was just described in that comment is about the human being that is persisting in the attachment.
Right, and the fact that that you don't think that certain stuff that's in your home, that either that's where the dog sat, that's where the dog played, you don't believe that there's some sort of feelings and essence that's still left there. It'll die out in time, but it's like a lot of this is coming directly from the human's way of thinking. But it can also be that, isn't there a possibility that you pick up something and you go to move it and it smells like my cat? Well, because the cat slept there. The cat's not there anymore, but the smell's still in the fabric. Why don't you wash it? You know, it'll help you move on. But it's like they just, how can I say, they just have their energy and their forces in any form that they're in. And when the form is gone, the energies will move onward. Yes.
Well, the animals that we have as pets are no longer normal.
That's true.
If you want to know the difference between your cat and what a cat is like, go observe some feral cats.
Yeah.
They're very different. So they have picked up psychological things from us. They're very impressionable.
Yes.
So much of what we love about a particular pet of ours was our own goodness reflecting back from them. So domesticating them is not really right. They need to learn and grow of their species, not mixed with human.
And have you ever noticed, if you ever gone to a dog park, how many animals, or how many people, we don't know how, their owners, do they begin to look like them? No, it's a true fact. It's a true fact. And it's like, gee, he looks like just like the guy. He's walking. So you think about, there's constantly movement of vibrations of things, constantly. But for most of us that have been around and watched how the animal kingdom, for instance, has had to survive and fight just to live, even those in the wild especially, of what humanity is doing to cut down their whole flocks, their whole atmosphere, their whole growth. And again, it's that thinker that wants that ivory that he's going to make a lot of money on. Yes.
It just makes me think of a quote I read, and I don't know if it's true, and I don't remember who said it. It was one of the P's, like Pythagoras or Paracelsus.
One of those P's.
One of the P's. And I can remember. But it said, until one has loved an animal, a part of one's soul remains unawakened.
Oh,
and I'm wondering if that's compassion.
That is compassion.
Yeah.
That's true compassion.
Yeah.
And an animal can sense that. He or she can sense it. And it's natural to want to curl up and be near that. So it's no more as it was at the very beginning, because now people are really into animals. And we think you can learn a lot from an animal, because in a way, their senses keep them in line in their way of living. And a lot of the problems come from the outer inflictions that come from humanity. And if it ends in true that it's all intelligence, it's all soul, and we're all at different degrees of development, we can be the ones that can help that raise up, or we can be those that can push them way down. And so we should never again maybe think of this animal quality that we think of as negative, because 9 times out of 10, it came from the human. So we have to learn how to act and react too. So this whole system will get us into, maybe that's the reason the last one's coming up on vegetarianism. People just don't understand it, don't want it, don't want to interfere with it. Let each have their growth in their time. So for those of us who have had pets or have pets now, let's really seriously think how we are helping that or how we're degrading it. So hopefully we'll see you next Sunday. That's it.
get that?
You got it.
I got it.